There were three questions that we had posed subsequent to the last class on either email or Facebook Messenger or something like that. And Bill asked one of them. He's not here, so I may skip the first question, which is a particular favorite of mine, to see if he gets here. And if he, we'll just change the order of it. If he doesn't get here later, then we'll just do it anyway. So, okay, then good. I can group it into yours.
Was look at little independent of free versus not. It seems like it's loaded.
Loaded term, yeah.
Yeah, like free will. Like that. But what about will? And then explore it from that perspective.
Okay. We'll make that question three. We'll do these two first and then get to that one at the end in the hopes that Bill happens to make it today. So the second one I think is relatively short. It's an interesting take on the classic question of why do bad things happen to good people, which is a deep question because it strikes at the heart of whether God is a coherent idea. Kind of the popular level of people don't think about it of, well, if God's all good, then and he's all-knowing and he's all-powerful, then he ought to have been able to build a world that doesn't have any evil in it. Clearly, this world's all messed up, so therefore there is no God. That's not a formal version of the argument, but it basically follows along those lines. And that one's been answered for a while, and I think the logical problem of evil has finally been put to bed in philosophy. I don't know of anybody that, not that I know the literature well, but I don't know of anybody that still maintains that the logical problem of evil is still there. That is to say that it's logically incoherent to have both evil in the world and have an all-good God or an all-powerful God. Thank you. Is it coming through okay? You got a decent level. It may just be ugly, but still works okay. Story of my life. The idea of the moral, the emotional problem of evil is still very much out there. It's one that requires a significant amount of interaction and careful interaction. And it's stuff that we've talked about in this class before. And I've kind of laid out for you the model that says, you know, what if, I like the what if there's the A, B, and C. Has everybody in here seen me do the A, B, and C group people? Has anybody not seen me do the A, B, and C group people thing? Okay. Since he's a philosophy major, I'll go through it really very quickly. But basically, it'll feed into this one, so it'll be a quick restatement. But basically, what if, you know, if you're going to say, why would God build a world like this? You're talking about the concept of purpose. So before you turn around and decide, is this world a good world, you have to ask, good for what? Because if the purpose of the world is to showcase God's holiness, purity, and goodness, then one that has a bunch of evil in it, you might say, well, hang on, that doesn't do a great job of doing so. Why isn't the world more holy, pure, innocent, you know, majestic, whatever? So if you decide, you almost have to ask a question of purpose. Now, what if God is, you know, we've got all these alls that God is, all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful, omnipresent, all-present, that kind of thing. If one of the things he is all-loving, then one of the things he might be concerned with is entering into relationships with created beings in which he has a love relationship with them and they have a love relationship between each other. So if love is the highest ethic, I'm skipping a bunch of stuff here, but if love is kind of the highest ultimate ethic, if that's really what God's about and what the world's about, if that is the ultimate moral good, then what you would imagine is the purpose of the world has something to do with love. Now, if the purpose of the world has something to do with love, and the definition of love has two separate major components. One is a benevolent regard. That is to say, you want good for the, you want what's actually good for the other person, and that it's selfless. If those are the two major things that love is, and that's Merriam-Webster's definition, a selfless, this definition three, a selfless benevolent regard for someone else. If that's what love is, then at the end of whatever this world is, the purpose of it might be something like bringing people into as many people as can love God as possible together. That you want to maximize the number of people that love God, or that you want to optimize per some population that you can create, the number that enter into a love relationship with God. But there's a problem that touches on what we'll get to in question three of will or free will. If God is just going to sit here, and so the purpose is something like max love, just make it simple and call it that without getting too much into what the definition of that is. But, and then what we're going to say is, now God's, we're starting with God, and then he's going to make other people, and those other people can go one of two ways. Now why can they go one of two ways? They can either choose to love God and be loved by God, or not love God and be loved by God. Or maybe they are still loved by God, but they don't choose to love God. So in that case, this desired end state has been broken. So you want the minimum number of these, and you want the maximum number of these. What if that's the purpose for the world? This all seems to kind of follow from the concept of who God is and what he does. So if that's the case, if that's what you want, the problem is going to be free will. Or as the Matrix, of the movie The Matrix said, choice, the problem is choice kind of idea. And if the problem is choice, what is obvious is if God wants something benevolent for all of his creatures, he could just make all of his creatures love him. But if he makes somebody do something, that is to say, he is choosing what he himself wants, then he is not being selfless. And as a result, he's not actually engaging in love. He's engaging in some kind of benevolent determinism. So the problem, one of the problems that I don't not think a lot of people in the literature have hit, has been that determinism entails an absence of love, if love is requires a choice. Now, the reason I would say love kind of intuitively requires a choice, we've said before here, a shotgun wedding where you're forced to marry someone that you don't want to. You wouldn't say that's a love relationship. You've been forced to do it against your will, so you don't love the other person. You're made to marry them. Whereas if you marry someone because you love them, it's obviously that your choice had something to do with the matter. So choice seems to be key into entering into a love relationship. But now God's got a problem. If he makes wills that are as free as his own, let's assume that his will is maximally free and that he wants other people's wills to be maximally free, then there is some sort of probability, there's certainly a possibility, we don't know the probability, there's certainly the possibility that some of these people freely choose not to love God. Now, the question is, well, if God is so smart, why can't he make it so that everybody freely chooses him? Well, the point is, it may not be possible for that to happen. It may not be feasible for that to happen. And the way that we talked about that last time was, what if there are people who will only choose to obey God, who God is going to say, I'm the one with the knowledge, you're the one without knowledge. I'm going to give you knowledge if you trust me. And the knowledge is how to maximize your happiness, how to be maximally in love with me and other people. The people have to say, yes, I will take that knowledge in, or no, I don't trust you. And really, that was a question in the garden. I don't necessarily want to trust God. I'll listen to you, serpent, and maybe you're right. So it was a lack of trust in God. So this was a choosing not to listen to God's instruction on how to love. And as a result, it goes kind of the other way. It was a not loving thing to do to God, to not listen to the person who properly would be the grounding of all your knowledge. So if that's the case, maybe we'll just throw a naive estimate out there. If you create two people and they both have equally free will, maybe one of them chooses to love you and the other one chooses not to love you. So there's no reason to say that that is the probability, but we just make it that way for sake of argument. So what if it is that the world is comprised of maybe three kinds of people? We call them group A, B, and C, just for simplicity. And the group A people are people who in any possible world, or in every feasible world, will choose to say yes to God. The C people are people who there's no possible world, or there is no feasible world, let me say it that way, there is no feasible world where they will say yes to God. Now what might that mean? Is there a possible world that's not feasible for them? And what I mean by that is, let's say there's a world where they say yes to God. But that world is only a world where God says to them, here's what I want you to do to obey me. In order to love me, I want you to kill Kelly. All right, so that doesn't seem like it's not loving on all sides. So it's God ordering somebody to do something that is morally wrong. Well, that, while not strictly logically possible, turns out to be broadly logically impossible because an all-good being can't order you to do something against his own commandment. Let's say he's already issued the commandment of do not murder. So I've skipped through something there. Basically, if someone decides on their own to kill Kelly, then God will say, yes, that's what I want you to do, and so you're loving me. So since that world's not feasible for God to create, maybe it is that there are C-type people who maybe we would just call evil people. They're just people that like to do bad things. And they just, there's no way to offer it to him. I offer as an example of this one only because he said so himself. I don't know that this is the case, but Christopher Hitchens, as an example, said he does not want to live in heaven, even if there's a God and a Jesus, because to him it's a divine North Korea with a great leader and his son the dear leader, and he doesn't want to live in that environment because he doesn't want to live under a dictatorship, and he sees even an all-loving God as being a dictator. All right, so let's say that that's a C-type person. He just doesn't want to say yes to God. So God wants to maximize these. He wants to minimize these. But what if you get more of these? Sorry, these always say yes. So here's the B people. The B people can sometimes, in some worlds, say yes, and some worlds they say no. And I have made the argument that these are like me or my kid. If I say to my one kid, "Don't touch that. That's hot," he pulls back and says, "Okay, I'm not gonna do it." Not because he knows what hot means, but because I said no. He's just a very obedient kid. The other kid who leads with his face has to either experience him. I pointed at the go-kart muffler, new engines on it, by the way, so we're rocking and rolling. And I said, "Don't touch that, it's hot." And he was like, "Hot." Boom, puts his hand right on it. Now he figures out it's hot, and he says, so he had to experience the evil for himself in order to know that my commands were good. So now he trusts me more because he burned his hand. The other kid trusted me implicitly. This kid trusts me more because he had the experience. There are other kids who are a little bit wiser who watch their brother or sister get told, "Don't touch it." They touch it, they get burned. They're like, "Ooh, that was bad. I'm not going to do that." So that's another type. So people here, these are people who don't have to experience evil to say yes. These are people who will only ever experience evil because that's what they choose freely. And these are people who, when they observe other people do evil or they themselves do evil, they learn to trust properly God and enter into this max love relationship with him. So the world, you might think then, is, since these are kind of set, so to speak, these right here are the ones that have some sort of future dependency of what the world looks like in order to come into their decision yes or no. So what you want to do then, if you're God and your purpose is to maximize the amount of people who are entering a loving relationship with you, is you want to build the world that gets the greatest ratio maybe of these people to come to you. Now, I don't know whether this is done in absolute numbers. I don't know if this is some sort of optimization of ratio, but given the size of the population, the maximal amount of these B people come over to your side, and that the A and B together are more the greatest ratio against C, that kind of thing. That's up to God. I'm not really sure, but I can see cases where you would set different parameters and get different answers on that one. So if that's what you do, then you would expect to see evil in this world. Because some of these people need to see people doing evil, and some of these people need to experience evil so that they may ultimately come into saying yes.
So, do you believe then that all evil is instructive?
No. Well, is all evil instructive? I think that there can be, based on this one, I don't want to take that position because it's a heavy burden to bear. And so I think you're asking, tell me if this is wrong, is there a difference between evil that results in good and evil that's what we call gratuitous evil? Because the real problem of evil has to do with gratuitous evil, evil that has nothing to do with nothing. Even the evil that we call gratuitous. Now, what I mean by that is, let's take a C person, and there's another, let's say, C person as well. By the way, I should probably declare ahead of time. I think that the world that we live in means that only these people don't end up choosing God. That everybody who has the possibility to choose or not choose God ends up choosing God. That's the way that I think this world is. I know, I see. I can explain that later when we talk about will. But the best possible world, I think we can all agree, would be that world, where you maximize the number of people here. So remember, I already said the C people are people who in no feasible world will choose God. So is there a feasible world where B people choose God? The answer is yes. Now, is that a common world to all of them? Or do you have to optimize that one? I think God's smart enough to figure out a common world to that. I may be wrong about that. So maybe that's too big one to hold, but I'll try to hold that position. Gratuitous evil ends up being between C people. Okay, so this guy beats, rapes, murders this other guy or girl or whatever else. And so guy X and guy Y, this evil interaction that happens, you say, well, there was no purpose to that because nobody observed it. It didn't bring another B person into a right relationship with God. It wasn't instructive to the B or the A. So why did that happen? Well, first, even if it was apparently gratuitous, now I don't grant that that was actually the case. We may not know whether those actions actually had any impact over here. because it's a physical world. But that seems a little bit of a stretch. So let's say that the other thing that happens is this. And here, let me briefly step out of the question and give you a story to think about. Imagine that you find yourself, instead of you've lived in this world, and when you first popped into existence, you're standing in heaven. It's us. It's just us sitting there, and there's God on his throne, and very anthropomorphic in this case, but there's God on his throne, and he says, the guys and gals at these two tables right here are people who would have always said yes to me, and the rest of you, losers, would never have said yes to me. And so I want you to, so if you guys don't mind, step off into eternal destruction where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. The rest of you get welcome into the blessedness of your Father. How does that feel to you? Are you satisfied with the fact that that happened? Now, you know God. Let's say maybe you know him and you realize, okay, he does know everything. So you don't have an intellectual problem with, was he right about that, maybe. But what is the first thing that's going to come out of your mouth? That's not fair. Why don't you give me, let me show you, and then we'll have proved it. So this gratuitous evil proves to the X, at least, if the X is the doer of the evil, it proves to the X that he is, in fact, worthy of condemnation. The Y, ostensibly, is not, remember, the Y here is a C, is not an A. Or, I'll give you an example where the Y here might be an A. If you think an abortion, I'm very anti-abortion, if you think abortion is wrong, this is an abortion doctor and this is an innocent baby. Well, in my opinion, the Y goes to heaven because they're innocent, and the X has done something worthy of condemnation, i.e. he's killing babies. Let's make it a late term, the horrible, you know, I won't describe it. The worst case abortion where you're just like, wow, that does seem morally disgusting. Let's make that the case. So the apparent gratuitous evil, it did, in that case, maybe it wasn't gratuitous because it resulted in somebody going to heaven. But in that case, you're proving to this person you are worthy of condemnation by his own actions. So in my mind, maybe all gratuitous evil fits into that category, what we would otherwise call gratuitous evil.
So it's proving to the person going to hell that you deserve being in hell?
Yes. Well, so I say to both. Because when we watch, when you guys, good guys back there, watch the rest of us, that happen to us, you say to yourself, if you're properly aligned to what is just and what is not just, you say, that is just. And so the idea is that you watch the justice happen. Now, the great thing is, in this version right here that we talked about, there's no room for mercy. And I think mercy is a big thing that has to do with love. So the even greater thing is for everybody in the room to be like, you know what, I really don't deserve to be with God. But God says, I've offered every single one of you the choice to come here instead of going there. And we were like, see you later, and they walk. You who are left are going to be like, God couldn't have done much more than he did. That, you know, what else do you want? He's both just because they are justly condemned, but he's also merciful in that he even offered it to them and they didn't want it. So that's how I see that one. Now, obviously, there's a lot of back and forth that can go on this one. That was all set up to answer what was the other question. Why do good things happen to evil people? Good things happen to evil people so that for a couple of reasons. One, for the B people, they see that God loves people not based on what they do. God loves people not based on what they do. That is part of the definition of love. Because you're being benevolent, so that's God being good to people. But to people who are not good to you, so that is very selfless. Selfish, you could selfishly be good to people who are good to you. Why? Because it'll increase their regard for you, and so you know this love just keeps walking its way up, and there's some benefit in it for you. A very pure form of love might be one where you love somebody even when it hurts you, even when it costs you. That kind of love, that sacrificial love, we say in Christian theology and in terminology, is very selfless. And that kind of love is a proof to these teams, that God is really all-loving and maximally loving. And to even these people, it takes away more of their justification for shaking their fist in his face, being like, you never did any good thing for me. And he says, I gave you the breath of life. I gave you the shirts on your back. I gave you a world to live in, oxygen to breathe, food to eat, all these other kinds of things. And then they say, yeah, but these evil things happened to me. And what he then says is, I have told you, and you know intuitively not to do these things, but when you began to disobey me, you walked down a path where you have said, I don't want you in my life, and I say, okay. Which is ultimately what this world is. This world is us saying, God, we don't want you in our life. We're going to walk our own path. It started at the garden. It continues today. The kingdom of God are people who have reversed the path and said, we want to live under the theocracy of God, and we will do so even though we geographically live in this world, we'll have these little pockets of, like what sort of church is supposed to be, people who live under the theocracy of God, and they live and walk and work in a different direction than the rest of the world does, and that should ultimately bring good to those people, and that the people who go down this evil path will see the natural fruits of their evil, which are kind of obvious. I mean, a lot of times we see something happen to people like that, they kind of had it coming to them. Even when we don't say they had it coming to them, a lot of times people will say, well, people should have seen that this would result in that. I mean, to the addict, to the drug user, the people that are outside, you kind of look at them and you're like, well, yeah, they're in the throes of addiction right now, but you know, it started this way, I can see how they got there. Love and mercy, though, turn around and say, now that they've gotten themselves so bent that they can't straighten themselves, you go in and you help them. And God always offers that to everybody, A, B, and C. So you'll notice that the offer of salvation, the offer of restoration, the offer of all these things being good actually goes to all three groups. Were God only to offer it to A and B, then you might have a case, but he offers A, B, and C, which shows that he is very much maximally loving, in my opinion. Now, why else do good things happen to evil people? Well, one, he does need to sustain them in his existence long enough to be the moral object lesson for B and A as well. So some of it is, you know, you keep the cannon fodder alive if you want to be diabolical about it, which God is not diabolical, but there's a practical reason for that to happen. So it's a combination, I think, of this broad grace that illustrates who God is and also the keeping the people there and in a place to have. So imagine this. Imagine, back to the kid example. You've got your one kid here who's older, and you got the younger kid, and you put the younger kid into a room full of hot plates that are on. You don't say anything to him about it. And you just sit there with the older kid watching. And the older kid's starting to get a little upset because he knows what will happen if this kid touches. And sure enough, the kid goes and touches something. And you say, was that good? And I say, no, because God never gave that person, or you, the father, mother, never told that kid, don't touch the hot plate. So he's ignorant. He doesn't know that that's bad. Well, one, it's hard to make that claim in this world because I think we all grow up with a moral sense, a conscience, and that kind of stuff that over time can be dampened, can be seared. But initially, if you think back to when you were a kid and you first did things wrong, how visceral an experience that was, that's the natural state. The natural state is to know how evil something is when you do it. And it's only over time that we dampen that visceral reaction, sometimes. So now some morals are instructive, some things are instructive, i.e. you have to learn about them. But the great moral truths, I think, are very much intuitive.
Sorry,
yes, sir. Yes.
I'm not making you go to hell.
Yep.
But I know that you're not going to choose, correct?
Yes. To expound on that point, this whole idea is founded on the idea of truly free will, what philosophers call libertarian free will, which I object to the term because libertarian, free, and will, to me, are like saying will, because to me, a will is something that is, by definition, both free and libertarian. So it's a redundancy to say it. To me, if you say, well, there's libertarian will where I can choose to do it completely freely, or bound will where it's really, really, really hard for me to do that, or maybe impossible. Well, if it's impossible, it's not free at all. And if it's mostly constrained, then I have a hard time seeing how that's fair in any sense. So this is, in my opinion, based very much on the idea of libertarian free will. If no free will, then none of this system is coherent. Yes, sir. Steve, and then Skyler, and then Randy, and then Skyler, and then Steve. Yeah, I think so. Good for explaining to everyone how, one, is God just? So it answers the problem. It is a, to my knowledge, one of the few systems that someone put forward that has a intuitive and, in my opinion, satisfying explanation for why God would allow so much evil in this world. Because when you turn around and you say, well, now let's say you want to start saying the proportion of evil in this world seems to me to be greater than it ought to be. Well, now you're already saying that there is some prior probability of who these three groups are, and then saying, well, I think I know what that is. The second is, even when you know how evil this world seems to be, I turn around and point out to you that the A group includes every baby that's ever died, if conception is where human life really begins, every baby that's ever died from conception. This is chemical pregnancies, on out to miscarriages, on out to abortions. These numbers are in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of people who have died and gone straight to heaven in this system. And then you turn around and be like, oh, I kind of have to factor those in as well. So yeah, we've got 6 billion people or however many 7 billion people we got now. And again, you'll remember from my definition of what we, I guess we'll talk about it with faith, but my definition, it's not just people who happen to be in Baptist and Bible churches in America that go to heaven. There's a broader scope of people, including ancient Jews, including people who are not Jews, including a whole rash of people who have faith in what God has revealed to them properly. Yes, sir. So I'll give you two answers to that. The short answer, or the blow-off answer, is this. Do you like science? Because science is post-hoc explanation as well. We turn around, we take data, and we make inferences from it. So this is an inference to the best explanation, maybe you could say that, the way that I've written it out here. Now, you'll notice that I did make specific references on A, B, and C to possible worlds and feasible worlds. So although I haven't completed it, I'm in the middle of writing the argument for this one too, which says, if then a maximally great being exists, then, and he's going to create a world. So this is a maximally great being, and we're also going to grant to that maximally great being as part of his greatness free will, because a being that has free will is going to be greater than a being that doesn't have free will. So now we've got a maximally great being that we think has free will, necessarily, and we're going to say, in all possible worlds, which world, is there any world that he has to create or cannot create? And either you'll end up with kind of a Leibnizian conclusion of this is the greatest of all possible worlds, which is where I think that argument ends right now. I just want to shore it up a little bit. Or alternately, you can say he has the freedom to choose from a set of worlds, and this is one of those set of worlds. And they're a range of the possible worlds that obtain from a certain set of from deductively derived premises from the concept of a maximally great being. So it's an ontological argument to what world we have to get here. And I'm not saying that this world is necessary. It's a contingent world, but it's maybe the only contingency is God's decision to create it. And that after that, the world becomes necessary. Yes, right. Yeah, the problem is it like the problem of evil, like the normal answer to the logical problem of evil, it all depends on, it is the case that God might have a possible reason for doing things. So there's a hidden calculus here that certainly we cannot discover directly unless we're going to do so from God's character, in which case you're back to the answer to your question being, well, the inferential science would have been the first step that then leads you to making the deductive series of arguments from the idea of a maximally great being. As well. So I think ultimately, for me, it all ends in the philosophy, which is why I'm trying to head there myself. Skylar.
So you went on your piece about libertarian free will, and you seem to imply that every human has the same level of free will.
Yes, right.
So
yes. Yeah. Okay. Can you tell me more what you mean by distinction there? Excuse me.
I don't think I agree with that because I think the extreme example is people that are addicts. I think
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So hold your question, because that is exactly what I'm going to talk about here. So that is the absolute heart of the question, and it's a great objection. And in that sense, no. Maybe everybody is different. Yeah. But what I mean to say is the we'll talk about when we get to that one, Steve. So obviously you want to simplify, especially your core terms, as much as you can. So very briefly, this is a 10-second answer. This is the core of what love is, right here. This is both a necessary and sufficient condition for love, because if you can say, I can love myself. Well, if you can love yourself, then selflessness is obviously not part of the definition. So you only have to bring in selfless if that love is to another person. So if you're going to say, what is the definition of love? Very simply, it's wanting the best for an entity. Now, if that entity is yourself, okay, you're done with your definition, maybe, other than trying to figure out what is best, and this is what is good, and what is good is now you're into another set of moral objective or subjective considerations. I think objective. And if it's to another entity, then you have to add in selfless. Why? Because maybe part of the definition of good is doing things for that entity's also perceived, understood good. And if that's the case, then they at least have to know why that's happening. And that means if they have to know why it's happening, it can't be an automatic thing. There has to be some cognition that goes in for them to understand it. Now, that may be overly complicated. So if you don't like that, don't worry. It's just this. It's one and two. That's what love is.
Well, I guess
Yeah, that's true. But I would counter that by saying, and you don't have to have a great force of love in a vacuum, because at least as humans, you only got 60 seconds to love anyway. So. It'll be all over after that, because you're in a vacuum, you're going to die. Just kidding. Steve, and then Randy.
It seems to me that, well, I don't know how you end up in a C. How does somebody end up being a C?
The same way somebody ends up being an A. There's no difference between the two. So this is I don't like the term mystery, because mystery usually means I haven't figured out a consistent way to think about it. There's some paradox sitting in it, and so it's mysterious. I don't like mysteries that are mysteries due to paradox. I believe in mysteries that are mysteries due to, you know, hey, we've got some idea that the answer ought to be out there. We've got a reasonable, articulable way of saying we think this answer ought to be out there, but we don't have those data yet, so we can't complete the calculation. A mystery like that might be the edge of the universe, how far is it, that type of thing. Maybe we've got some good ideas of where we think it is. It's possible it's beyond that. We just don't have access to the data. That's a good mystery. A bad mystery is, in my opinion, articulations of the Trinity that are obviously self-contradictory. Well, it's just mysterious. No, you're saying it's both A and not A. That is not a mystery. That's a contradiction. So let's not use that term. Now, so I'm going to say this is mysterious in the better sense. It's mysterious in that We don't really know how God can create a will, and that will be truly free. And now, how does He predict what that will is going to do without having had some sort of deterministic input into what that will does? So, what I mean to say there is, if God creates a will, we, as people, that when we think of creating things, we think of creating computers and robots and, you know, other stuff like that are deterministic. So we feel like if God creates a will and He knows that will perfectly, then He's the one who set what that will do. So let me instead say it this way, and I will appeal to Scripture to do this. When we are created in the image of God, If God has free will, an image, think like a Xerox copy machine, what if he copies himself and puts that in this other creature? Now you might say to yourself, well, if he copied himself, he would be, it would be A to A, he'd be identical, so he'd be making another God. And so let's say that that's not what he's doing, because that's logically impossible, broadly logically impossible, because there can't be two maximally great beings like that. So if instead what he's doing is he's copying what is essentially what he is, and what if what he is essentially, one of the things he is essentially, is he's a free will. Can he copy that free will? I would say, even if we can't understand it, we would say that it seems logically possible, in fact maybe even probable, that an all-powerful, maximally great being could grant to a creature, if not all power, not all of the essential traits that he has, but some of the essential traits that he has, because he's not replicating it one for one and making it identical. And instead what he's doing is saying, I'm putting the image, he can say, he's putting the image of God on us. And that image, the core of that image, is a truly free will, one that can do A or C. And let's say that the devil one is one of those too. So here's maybe the second most powerful, maybe, creature in all of creation, first most powerful creature in creation outside of the creator. So the most powerful creature. And his will was completely free. So he knows maybe next as much as anybody that God does. He's almost as powerful as God is. And what did he choose to do? Well, he chose to say, no, I don't want to live under your reign. I want to do things my way. And now you get the first evil, possibly. I think theologians generally conceive of that as the first evil, not man. Man in the garden is the first evil. So if that's the case, and there's scriptural support for that, it's not excellent, but it's not, when I say not excellent, it's not so clear that we're like, yep, that's definitely it. But you do want to ask the question of where did the serpent come from? Because he clearly wasn't on God's team to start with. So he seems to have kind of been the first evil, and we usually put the serpent and the devil together, and then the description is the devil, as you've heard me say. So a long answer to your question, Steve, but ultimately, these are people who, let me see if I can come up with an analogy here. If you ever, who's the guy that said he hates the comedian that hated kids and dogs? W.C. Fields, was that right? No. I don't remember what his name was. At any rate, there's some people out there who, when you when you say, well, I'll give you a great example. We are so doting on our own children that it borders on probably spoiling them. We'd be very careful, try not to spoil them, but we went out and bought a remote control car for a 3-year-old yesterday. So I said to myself the day before, I'm not going to do this. It seems to be an expenditure of funds. It's not required. I may send them the wrong lessons. But then today I was like, come on, boy, let's get in the car. I know you love remote control monster trucks. Pay more for a monster remote control monster truck than is reasonable in any country but Japan. And so when I look at my own child and have a regard for him, I recognize that there is still a little battle that goes on. One of them is, selfishly, I want to go read a book or work on this paper or go watch a YouTube video rather than bend my will to supporting this child. But I'm smart enough now, thank goodness, to say, reading this book brings me some level of satisfaction, but raising this child in a godly and loving way, it brings me 10 times that much satisfaction. So even selfishly, it's smarter for me to bend my will to help this other kid out. When I read about other people who kill their own kids, molest them, these just horrible evils, half of me scratches my head like you do and says, how on earth can that be the case? Well, how on earth that can be the case is that it is not the first of an evil, that is the end of a series of evils. So maybe this is one point that I should have broken out earlier. When we look at when we talk about the evil in the world, we often talk about the most salient evils, the most evil evils, the 6 million Jews being thrown into, being killed, or many of them thrown into ovens, some of them alive, and all this horrible stuff, or rape and murder of children and these kinds of things. Nobody comes right out of childhood, a pure, well-raised childhood, and the first act is to go tear somebody apart limb from limb. That's just not how it happens. Evil, to that point, is always a progression, and almost always an obvious and notable progression. From this is where they started to choose to do the wrong thing up to, wow, this is a horrible evil. And I think of, I've actually read the story of Jeffrey Dahmer, who seems to be kind of like one of the most evil guys out there. So he's literally building piles of skulls of people he's killed and eaten in his room around a throne. And who was supposed to sit on his throne? He had believed himself a god, and he was building himself a shrine in his house. That was part of what he was doing. He didn't end up there overnight. There was a very clear progression. When you see him laying out his story, you're like, not what I would have chosen to do, but I can see how he got to where he was. And it makes twisted sense. It makes sense, but twisted sense. So some of it is, don't forget that these things are by degree. So when you say, how does somebody kill their child? Let's say that you were this was the stuff that I talked to young men in the high school group about. They're worried about, well, how am I going to, I want to keep myself pure until marriage. I don't want to sleep with somebody I'm dating. I'll say, I go Matrix on them. I was like, have you seen The Matrix? Most of them say no. So there's a scene in it where the Oracle's sitting next to Neo and offers him a piece of candy, and if you know everything, then you already know whether I'm going to take it or not. She says, I wouldn't be much of an Oracle if I didn't. And he says, then how can I make the choice? And she said, because you're not here to make the choice. You're here to understand why you made the choice. You've already made it. Now, that seems a little bit mysterious, but what they really mean is this. The Christian boy that doesn't want to sleep with a girl before he's married doesn't go from completely innocent right there to he walks into her house and then now he's sleeping with her. There is a progression of events that usually starts with he gets involved in some level of pornography, and it doesn't have to be crazy. It can just be a little bit, and that leads him to think of women in a certain way, and he starts thinking this woman a certain way, and when he doesn't stop himself from thinking that woman a certain way, now he's already basically mentally rehearsed some of the stuff that he's about to execute. And what I tell the guy is, you've already have this train of wrong thinking that's led you up to some point. So now you're trying to date her, and you've got two forks. One of them is you've got a train from the church telling you this is the way to do it, and you've got a train from the world telling you this is the way to do it, and they both represent opposite conclusions. Sleep with the girl, don't sleep with the girl. And I say, your best place to make that choice, if you're dating her, if you've already committed to dating, and I've got another series if you're not committed to dating, but if you're committed to dating the girl, when you put the car in park, if you sit in there past 10 seconds, you've already made the choice. If you willingly walk up to her apartment, condo, house, whatever, you know there's nobody in there, and they're in the house, and you walk across the doorstep with her, you have made the choice. Now, you haven't chosen to sleep with her at either one of those points, but the point to maybe one of the things Skylar's getting to is the brain chemical cocktail that's about to start affecting your reason is on its way, and now's the time to cut it off, because can you resist it at the very last instant? Yes, you can, but it is much, much harder to do it there than it is to say, I got a rule. I put the car in park, I count to 10, I'm already out by the time I hit 10, or it's game over. Or I don't cross the threshold with the girl, period. No exceptions, except for someone bleeding and dying in the house, and I got to go in the house, right? So that to me is key. You don't look at the C person and be like, well, you're just born that way. No, it was a notable progression from very small evils to great evils that gets you there, and there's a choice at every evil along the way.
Well, there's something you're saying that everybody is playing with a free sleep, and it's only by an environment that it ends up.
No, it's a combination of environment, which with environment comes temptation, and free will, and you're choosing to do it. Yes, so I mean, this goes back to, now I've written you 5 arguments and published them on the Facebook page of how it is not possible that we have a sin nature. It's not only have I said, let me argue it from Scripture, I've said it's not possible that we have a sin nature. Nobody, by the way, has written me back with a counter argument or an attack against one of the premises that shows the premise to be false. I'll leave that one out there, but if you want to attack that one, hit one of the premises of the argument and show where it's false, and I'm all for you. But then I've also got 4 other arguments you got to take down as well. okay, now let's move to, go ahead, Randy.
Sorry, just real quick. Based on your definition of love, do I love the Redskins?
No.
Okay. Even if I have benevolent regard for them, I want what's best for them.
Well, if you're willing to grant, it depends on whether you want to call love binary or on a spectrum. So you want to, I love somebody a little bit. If you can say that that's the thing, I have a mild benevolent regard for them, I kind of hope stuff works out for them. All right, that's a little bit of love. Hey, I really want it to work out for him. But I would say, if you're willing to go through a torturous sociological and psychological thought experiment of basically pointing out that loving the Redskins is just another version of loving yourself. The reason that you love the Redskins, it has to do with the fact that they're your team, and the reason they're your team, now it's an implied selfish thing, this is about you. That's why you don't love the Seahawks. Now, people who love the Seahawks that live in the Washington, D.C. area usually have some sort of connection to the Seahawks. So why is it that you choose the Redskins to love instead of any of the other teams out there? The answer is it's your team, and now, you know, I don't want to go through it here, but I'm sure you're smart enough to see where that's going. It basically boils down to, this brings me something, and it's selfish. And that maybe you can't even list every offensive lineman on there. So how can you say you love a guy whose name you don't even know, or you don't know anything about him? And the bottom line is you like the idea of the Redskins because the idea of the Redskins is something that brings something of psychological benefit to you. God loves every individual on the Redskins team. He does not give, in my opinion, a rip about whether the Redskins or the Cowboys win.
But when I say Redskins, I mean collection.
Yeah, yeah. I think he loves them as individuals. I think he loves them as individual people. And so, you know, is RG3 still on the Redskins? I follow none of this stuff. Okay. Who's the quarterback now?
Kirk Cousins.
So Kirk Cousins, he's a Redskin, but he's also, that's one community he lives in. He also lives in Ashburn, so he's an Ashburnite. He's also an American citizen. He's also, maybe he's got a poker team that he's on. Maybe he, you know, I don't know. What are all these things? He drives in a car club. What are all these things that he's part of? So why is he a Redskin? It's one of the many things he is. The bottom is, he is at his core essentially something, and that something is the image of God, and it's another will, in my opinion, a free will, and that's what God loves is that other free will, that other immaterial mind, soul, spirit. That's what loves. The rest of it are accoutrements that we cloak ourselves in. That on the last day, like Eustace in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, God will carve down and strip off all of these cloaks down to the core being of who we are, and that's what is examined and loved and judged. So that's what we should care about most. Good question. We're going to run out of time for three, so we'll take three off the deck until next class because I want that one to have a good long answer, but we'll go now finish as much as we can and in 15 minutes, 20 minutes, this one up. Strength of will. So, Skylar, if you want to re-ask your question, fine, or if everybody remembers it, we can go ahead.
No, just the way what you implied earlier was that everyone had an identical free will, and the implication was that it's of the same power or force, and in the actual world that we live in,
okay, now what I mean to say, so let me give you an let me argue for your position and against my own, and then I will explain why. It's a little bit of a straw man. I think we know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. I agree with it, but I want to say why. At base, I've been ill for the last week or so. While the true definition of free will actually isn't touched by these things. So an addict is a great example. And I'll give an example in my own case. There are some people, make the addict, make it yourself, make it a person that you know, who if you put a glass of alcoholic beverage of their favorite type, whether it's a truly fine wine, whether it's a great liqueur, whether it's their favorite beer, that to put it in front of them represents a level of temptation for them. So their will is weakened, you might say. You feel like their will is weakened. Right now, there's no beer in front of me. I don't want any beer. I'm good. Someone puts your favorite beer in front of you, and now some percentage of your will, the resistance, has gone down. Now you're like, oh, well, you know, 60%, I don't really want it. And the other guy's like, and it's two for Tuesday or whatever else, and they're the first two are free. And now your will goes down even a little bit more. And so that's for the person that likes beer. I came from an alcoholic family, and I struggle with all kinds of things. Alcoholism, not at all. I could be swimming in what ought to be my favorite beverage and don't even care about it at all. Zero temptation for me there. Now, other things, huge temptations for me. But for me, no temptation. Now, does that mean that my will is stronger than that other person's? And you would say no, only with regard to that particular set of temptations. Now, where do those come from? Now, in my case, you know, genetically speaking, you should say you have a very high probability of that being a great temptation for you. But there is a cognitive set of things that happen on top of those. And that may still be true. Like if I started to be an alcoholic, I have the genetic predisposition maybe to much more rapidly slide down that slope than somebody else might. Or other people might not slide down it at all, but I would. But because I saw my grandparents being such a bunch of jerks to each other and to their family just completely fall apart and my dad walk away from it, and what's obvious to me is that his walking away from it is what made our family good and that family evil, I'm like, ah, no problem for me. Because I have no prior commitment to it, I have no prior experience with it. And when I look at it, honestly, my friends doing it, I'm like, well, they look like idiots when they're in the throes of this thing, and I find them annoying, so I don't want to be an idiot, and I don't want to be annoying, and I have too much pride anyway. Also, my own personal pride is like, I don't want to look like a fool, so why would I do something that's going to reduce my judgment and making myself not look like a fool? So I have all these little loops that help me resist that kind of thing. Now, interesting to note this, though. Genetic predisposition. Environmentally, I've certainly been around it enough. I was in Air Force Academy and the Marine Corps. Alcoholism was the thing to do in the military. It was culturally, at least at the time, part of what you did, especially in the Marine Corps, because they're 30 years behind everybody else when it comes to the political correctness thing. So I was environmentally highly, highly encouraged to do it. In fact, the whole, like, I can't believe you've never drunk anything. You have to take a sip of this just so you can say you haven't. That's the level of, like, people were upset by the fact that I didn't drink alcohol, right? And I was like, I just no interest, man. I'm sorry. I don't know what to tell you. And so often I use the excuse of, well, my family were alcoholics, and so that's the reason, because it backs people off a lot. But it's easier than being like, I don't get it. Most people don't get the I don't get it thing. When you look in my case, what I valued actually changed my strength of will. So genetic predisposition to have a weak will, but I value these good interactions in the family. I value, maybe wrongly, pride, my own dignity. I value my own intelligence, and at the time, at least, the story was if you drank alcohol, it killed brain cells, and the brain cells couldn't come back. Now I think we know that the brain cells can regenerate, but at the time, I thought it would make you dumber, too. So I had all of these maybe selfish reasons, but I valued certain things. I valued dignity. I valued respect. I valued these things for myself, and so these were counter to those, and as a result, because of my value system, this stopped being a temptation for me. And what I would argue is if you have the proper value system and you believe that this being exists and you properly understand his moral system, that temptation evaporates. If not completely, then very much mostly. Now let's talk about the opposite end of that one. Let me attack my own position there. What if you put the will with the strength, God's own strength of will himself, and you put him into a situation where something's going to happen that he doesn't like? This is the garden. What does he do? He is sweating bullets, begging the Father to say, I don't want to drink this cup. But at the end of it, he can say, but not my will, but thine. So he knows he's going to go through a horrific however many hour period, but he understands the glory that may be on the other end of it. And maybe that it's his value system that allows him to say, all he has to do is tweak his value system. This is Jesus speaking, not me, but if it's Jesus saying, I am God on earth, I'm God as a man, the whole earth should be properly bowing at my feet and asking for my wisdom. But every time I preach wisdom, somebody's arguing with me about it and asking for a sign. After I've done 100 signs, they're still asking for another sign. And as it says elsewhere, he could have called, if he was on the cross, he could have had a legion of angels at his disposal instantly. And he doesn't do that. Well, and why, if just tweak his value system a little bit, and that would have been the right answer. But because this is what he's interested in, he was able to go through. I would not have been able to put up with that. I'd have said, nope, angels, step in. I've had it. That was enough. I wouldn't have been able to pull that off, honestly. So I think it's because of his value system that he was able to do that. So what I would say is properly align. If you're interested in strengthening your will, the place where that starts is properly aligning your value system, and the rest will flow naturally from it. So that's the way to strengthen will. So now I said that I would, maybe that works, maybe it doesn't. Okay? So let me pull off instead to the side and say, what I mean by will is this. Only the ability, the true ability to say yes or no, and maybe not even equally, but period, in any given choice. Now, the scriptural assurance of this one is there is no temptation that has taken you except that which is common to man, and God is faithful and with the temptation provide you a way out so that you may be able to bear it. I truncated the verse a little bit there, but That is the assurance that you have that you will encounter nothing in your own life that you can't actually say no to or yes to, depending on what the right answer was. And I will challenge you to do this. Think of the evil things that you've done in your life or things that you regard as evil in your life. And think about the moment at which you felt you made the decision. And given what I said earlier, think about where you kind of made the pre-decision, even there. And ask yourself this question. Did you ever run into anything that you literally couldn't say no to? If the answer is yes, now we got a case against free will. But I don't have, even as the stuff that I've done in my life, that very much vary from my own value system, at least now, and I thought at the time, I can't think of a single thing where I didn't have a choice. And so I always want to challenge people to say, tell me the time when that happened in your own life. Yeah, I'm sorry, yes, sir. Go ahead. So unless you know the truth, you cannot do good. I will say, I will almost completely agree with that, other than if you did good accidentally, but let's just throw that out as, you know, nobody's that lucky. So yeah, I'm with you. I agree. You gotta know the truth in order to do good. Or maybe using the same terms, you have to know the good to do the good. And you gotta know the evil to do the evil. Or at least you have to understand that there's a choice. And to back Steve's point, I know you got another one, I'll get back to you. To back Steve's point up this far, this is Paul saying, where there is no law, there is no sin. So if you don't know what's right and wrong and you do something, God doesn't hold you morally accountable. A moral choice, and that's really what we're talking about, by the way. Skyler pointed it out, I didn't follow up on it. But we're really talking about moral choices here, not I like red clothes and blue clothes. We're talking about moral choices here. So unless you know that the choice is moral and you know the two moral options or more moral options, you are innocent of making a moral mistake if you choose anything.
So I would say that unless you know that God loves you, you're going to try and get love from someone else.
That's true. Unless God loves you, you're always going to try to get love from somebody else. One, trying to get love from somebody else or loving somebody else, to my opinion, is an evil. That's good. So I don't see a problem with that. You disagree that trying to get other people to love you is evil or good? I think it's good. Do you want to be in a relationship of love with other people, or are you saying it's okay to be in a relationship of hate?
I think selfishness is
on the evil side of the spectrum. Is it selfish to drink coffee or water, do you think? You think it's immoral to drink water? It's not a moral question. Okay. All right, fair. I'll say that, but drinking water is a selfish act. Now, you might not say it's a moral selfish act, but it's a selfish act, i.e. you're not doing it for Skylar, you're doing it for Steve. So I think that if God didn't want us to be, well, think of it this way. Here, I'll solve your dilemma for you. Are you built in the image of God? Yes. If you're built in the image of God, then not loving the image of God in yourself and not caring for it, if you're a temple of the Lord, not caring for your temple is evil. Right or wrong? So if you accept that premise, that taking care of your image of God or taking care of the temple is good, then now you have a moral obligation to look after yourself. And I think that's part of maybe the reason, maybe it's the entire reason that God doesn't say, love your neighbor and don't love yourself. He says, love your neighbor as yourself. He wants you to do it at least in a 50-50, maybe, if you took it at its face value there.
Well, I think the question is, are you taking on yourself?
Say that again.
Are you depending on yourself? Or are you depending on God? Is there a dependency in the right place?
Are you taking it as a dependency question? Are you depending on yourself, and what for what? Are you depending for what on yourself or on God?
For
happiness, yeah. Well, I would say that whether you reckon, so the truth would be this. if the classical theism is right, and I agree with classical theism, then God is causally sustaining the world, including you, all the time. So you are ontologically dependent on God. So to think that you don't depend on God is false. And so like you said earlier, you kind of have to know the good. But now we're going to get a little bit into kind of some ideas that are like planting as ideas that say we have properly basic beliefs of certain things. And I actually think, I agree with him that a properly basic belief is that God exists. And part of his evidence is that the vast, vast, vast majority of the world believes in what he says, quote, God or something like God. And so I think that it's built in each of us, as the scripture says, is a knowledge that God is a God or God is out there. And I think that if people are being smart at all, if they're even bothering to think at all, you kind of have to ask the question of what purpose is there in the world? And there's not a lot of steps to this. And so I think a lot of this is actually is intuitive. I think a lot of this is intuitive. Maybe not this system is intuitive, but this kind of stuff is intuitive. You know you want love. You already kind of pointed out that was one of the major choices. I think that we all know that there's God there. And ultimately, and we can argue that another time, but ultimately, that between these things, if you just think about it a little bit, you'll kind of get there. But I don't think you and I disagree. I think I agree with what you're saying. But yeah, I think we're dependent on God. And if what you're saying is this, maybe if what you're saying is, I want to enter in a love relationship with God, or alternately, I want to fill that relationship that I ought to have with God with loving other people. If that's what you're saying, yeah, I'm with you. But it's not wrong to want to love other people. Yeah, yep.
So I wanted to keep more of my money than was possible.
Yes, okay.
But if I know that God's going to take care of me, if I know that you mentioned your value system,
yes.
You know that's right. And you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that's right. So in that case, that was where I was saying if you have the proper value system, it dissipates. But even in that case, that is different than what you were talking about earlier, which is the desire to love other people. Well, if you take somebody else's money, you're not loving them. So that's a selfish but unloving thing to do to other people. So a selfish thing that doesn't affect other people might be, here's a stream of water flowing by, I'm thirsty, I drink the stream. Because other people can drink from it too. A selfish thing might be, I'm going to dam it up, and the people downstream can't drink from it. Okay, yeah, so getting somebody who's married, it'll be selfish and get somebody else who's married to love you. All right, in that case, I would say that's wrong, but here's the problem. It is, in my opinion, by the real definition of love, because of this word, Steve, and this is a terrific question because it really cuts it down to its core. It is impossible for you to love a married woman and have her love you if what you mean by love is she leaves her husband and comes and lives with you. Why? Or she sleeps with you after leaving the husband's house for a day. Because that's not benevolent, either for her or for you. It doesn't bring you good, it brings you evil. So if you actually had the best way to love a married woman is to reinforce her marriage as best you can and to also look for the person from God who he has for you or something like that. So you have to remember that you can't just, one cannot just ignore what the definition of benevolent is. We mentioned it earlier, but you got to know what, like you said, you got to know what good is. And if you get good wrong, you're going to get love wrong, which is exactly why in our society today, love is something that is sold as a Victoria's Secret, not something that is found on the pages of Scripture. That's a misdefinition of the benevolence that is in there. But good point, Steve. All right, final question, because we're almost, somebody's got 60 seconds for their last question.
Okay. So
yes, sir.
On your A, B, and C, that is, there's a percentage, there's a 60-40 split, whatever that is. Yeah. Is that number
So if you're going to say temporally, if you're going to take, yeah, temporally, then yeah, then these no's are going to yeses. Because remember, in the model that we're talking about, yeah, these are starting out as no's, basically.
The split between
this right here.
Yeah.
Oh.
Is the world getting better? Are we getting more and more yeses?
Right, and so this line is moving over time. If this represents the entire population of bees that will ever live.
No.
No.
Yes. Right now.
This is a snapshot of the world right now.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. If you do it that way, I can't have drawn it this way. Then what I have to do is draw it like this. Let each X represent people. Because this right here, the containment of the circle implies that that this group is complete. It's a group set theory kind of way of looking at it. So these are people right here. So what it is, what's happening in the world today is, this is the right direction, that's the wrong direction. This guy went this way, this guy went this way. Here's your snapshot in time. In 2 days, this guy goes this way, this guy goes that way, this guy goes that way. Another snapshot, this happens, that happens, that happens over time. So that's how it happens. Then at the end of it, you're like, this represented your B group, and this represented your C group, and then you split them that way. Yeah, good point. All right, the hook just showed up, so thank you all very much for your time. I hope this was helpful for you, and write in any future questions. If not, we're back to our topic that's very selfishly helping me out with with stuff to present this fall.